Let's make it happen, Captain!
From deep inside the Death Star, I'm Larry Larson.
And I'm Gov Maharaj.
Welcome to Defrag. Gov, how you doing today?
Oh, not too bad.
What's news in your world?
Oh,
40 million?
Oh, yeah, the 40 million licenses of Windows 8.
Yeah.
Some great news. We're supposedly doing better than where we were at the same time at Windows 7.
Yeah.
Can only hope that it keeps growing.
Yeah.
So people, try it, buy it.
That's good. What's new with me? I've got a couple of live events coming up here, flying out San Francisco tomorrow. Holidays, a lot of people in low power mode right now for the holidays. So we'll...
people are taking all of the vacation that they weren't able to take over the past 2 years.
And use it or lose it. Yeah. So, I don't know. I think we'll probably keep shooting the rest of the year, maybe next week at least.
Yeah,
we'll see. We'll see how we do. All right, so let's get to the questions. First one's from Stu. He says, I've got a little Outlook issue for you. I use Outlook 2013 for both emails and RSS feeds. One of the feeds I download is TechNet Blogs. However, this evening, a Polish blog article was downloaded. Every time I try to open it or when it first came in and was at the top of the page with the reading pane on, it caused Outlook to crash when I was switched to the switch to the TechNet folder. I eventually managed to start Outlook with the no preview switch and move the item to the recycle bin. However, I'm now wondering what was causing it. Please find attach proc dump file, problem step recorder file, and offending article. If you need any other further information, let me know.
I mean, in this particular case, you know, the Outlook uses HTML rendering, and I'm pretty sure with this dump that was actually the cause of it. What you can do in this case is, you know, make sure that you're up on the Office updates. I've got an additional inquiry of this particular issue out.
Yeah.
And, you know, we'll see if we can get it addressed. But you solved it the exact right way by moving that so it's not...
No preview.
Yeah. Or, you know, accessing a web view version and then clearing that out.
Yeah.
You can also, you know, set up a new PST. You can do a whole bunch of different things in order to clear that out. But the no preview is obviously the easiest
way.
It'll
look easy, like an easy solve.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
You can go to Microsoft.com or Office.com, office.microsoft.com, and you can actually look for the various command line switches there for resetting Outlook. So that if you have these kind of problems, you know, there's some additional switches about, you know, resetting your view state, no preview, you know, no rules. You can do a whole bunch of things in order to see if there's a particular thing offending your Outlook startup.
Yeah. Okay. And as you go back and forth, keep us informed, and we'll let you know what happened with that one. All right. From Brian, I have family members who don't understand the difference between WinRT IE and Desktop IE. Is there a way to set the desktop IE to be the default browser so links in the mail app don't open RT IE? Yes. What you do is you go to the desktop and start IE, and then you go to Internet Explorer Options, Programs.
Hang on.
You going there? All right. And then...
Tetch is being interesting on this with me. Oh, interesting.
It's your big fingers.
It's my big fingers indeed.
Yeah, so anyway, Internet Options, Programs, under Opening Internet Explorer, choose Always in Internet Explorer on the desktop, and then click on OK on the changes. So there you have that.
Yeah.
All right. From John, can you do an outline of creating a multi-boot machine? I've seen some tutorials, but they leave some gaps. As a developer, I was ready for Windows Phone 8, but I was not ready for the fact that the emulator required hardware virtualization. Unfortunately, none of my test machines support HV, so the option I tried was to dual boot my primary laptop and use a VHD of one of the Win 8 test machines as a secondary boot device. The result was a no-boot machine. The primary just showed... a blank screen for 10 minutes, and the VHD complained of a missing boot manager. I detailed my adventures here, and he's got a link. And a segment of the show using BCD edit would be appreciated. So let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, the requirement of SLAT hardware, secondary level address translation, is a requirement for Windows 8 to use the client Hyper-V. It's not a requirement if you're using server Hyper-V, because of the different types of workloads involved. Because of that, what I actually like to do is exactly what you did, which is using a native boot from VHD. And Scott Hanselman actually has a great article on how to do this. So his guide to installing booting Windows 8 developer preview. It works just as well for Windows 8 RTM off of VHD. You can have your native Windows 7 or Windows 8 even. This will still allow booting from a Windows 7 VHD. You do need to have professional if you're using Windows 7 or Ultimate or Enterprise. Mm-hmm. For Windows 8, you can use professional as well. And you know, this is the guide to the step-to-step guide to booting Windows 8 off of VHD.
Okay, so there you go. Go through that, and if you have any problems with that, John, just let us know, and we'll help you out. We're here for you. From Paul, is there a way to mount a removable drive as a fix so it can be added to the libraries? Having an expansion slot in the Surface is great, but the content on the drive won't integrate with anything because removable drives can't be added to the libraries. Yes, and there's an article on Win Supersite that we can bring up. Yeah, and as Gove plays with his machine there, you can see, here you go. Gove, tell us the pros and cons of this.
So Paul Thoreau has an article, he's had it for a while, of how to mount a micro SD. Yeah, the Surface comes with a micro SD slot.
Yeah.
As a mount point on your hard drive to fake library support for it.
Mm-hmm.
This will work, you know, it's technically possible to do. Problem is that if you're pulling up the drive, it's going to cause a full re-index. That's going to cause some performance issues if you're doing that repeatedly. So if you're putting in the micro SD into the Surface, leave it there. You know, don't take it out. If you're copying media to and from it, just use the USB port. You know, another USB flash drive or use the network or whatever to get data off and on that micro SD.
Yeah.
That way it won't trigger the re-index all the time.
Okay.
The other thing to notice is that, you know, you won't be able to boot from it. You know, so if you're thinking of trying to do that, don't.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty much the main caveats with using this. It's really simple. You just go through disk management and you give it a reparse point. To point to, you know, your C SD or some other folder on your C drive, and then you add in the libraries for your documents, music, video, pictures. So if you go and open up File Explorer and you go to your documents, you can just right click on it, go to properties, and here's your library. You can just add your SD card for it in here. And you just navigate to it, and it'll add it as a place. And you can actually set it as a default save location if you wanted to, so that any new stuff that you're saving off the web, if you're saving music, you're saving pictures, you can save it directly to that media drive so that you're not taking up all the space on your Surface. You know, if you have a 32 gig Surface, it has about 16 gig free.
Yeah, something like that.
So if you don't want to use up that space, then you can redirect that save to the micro SD card. You will not be able to install the applications there, just so you know.
So that would be a good place for like data and documents and stuff like that, and then save the Surface space that you have for apps.
Right.
I bought a micro SD last week. It's 32 gig. Around $20.
Yeah,
unbelievable.
Amazon had a deal for $38 for their 64 gig SanDisk, 64 gig SanDisk drive.
Yeah,
I picked up five of those.
It's so insane and it's so small. I was just like looking at that, thinking that's unbelievable. They can fit that much in such a small.
64 gig in this, and I remember, you know, drives. 2 gig.
Winchester drives. That dates me. I don't even want to talk about it. All right. Next one. I installed Windows 7 without Service Pack 1, and now when I'm trying to input Service Pack 1 key, I get an error. The error linked is the invalid product key. Can I activate it when I simply install Service Pack 1, or do I need to reinstall it from image with Service Pack 1?
Well, one, I'd like to know where the key came from.
Yeah.
You know, so...
Is it an OEM?
Yeah, we don't really have information on that. What you should be able to do is, if you have Windows 7 RTM Media, install that, Don't activate it, because you can install it without a key.
Mm-hmm.
Don't activate it, install Service Pack 1, and then use the key to activate that.
Yeah.
That should work. Otherwise, if that's still not working for you, again, I really wonder where this key came from,
because
you could actually have the wrong key for the type of media that you're using. Maybe you're trying to use an enterprise key, and that's not working. The other thing you can do is phone the telephone
dial
support.
The digits. Yeah, they'll help you out.
They will
if
at least
got a
tell
valid
you what
key,
kind of key it is.
Work with you. So,
yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so I'd just dial the number if you have a problem with that. From Anand, he says, I have hundreds of text files, and I need to search a particular word in these bunch of text files. How do I do that by selecting all the files and search for the word? I don't want to open each one and search for the word individually. I'm using Windows 7 here. So this one's pretty easy. I mean, if you've got your indexing turned on, you just go to Explore, and you go over to the search box, type in what you want, and it'll search through those text files for you.
Exactly.
And if they're all in one directory or in subdirectories of that one directory, you just type it in there, and it's going to find all of them for you. So there's the simplest way to do that, I think.
Well, that's the UI method of doing it anyways.
Okay, so you're going to bring up command line, aren't you?
I like command line.
All right.
You know, findster, space, spin. So this just searches subdirectories, case insensitive, and you search for the string that you're looking for. And you can do that in one of two ways. If it is a string with spaces in it, you want to go whack capital C colon. Where are my quotes?
Well, this is certainly easier than just clicking in the search box and Explore. I can see why you're so drawn to command line.
Command line using a touch keyboard is, you know, something that I would not normally do, but this is...
I'm going to check my email over here while you finish that.
What I am looking for, end quote,
I am,
space,
like will I am, well, one word.
Sure, whatever.
Okay.
And the file pattern that you're searching in, so star dot txt. So that particular command line will, you know, if I had a bunch of text files in this particular subdirectory, it'll search for that particular string of text in all text files.
Okay.
I use this a lot for searching for code.
Yeah, I could see that. All right. Next question from Yarrow Nesrael. Man, he's such a pest. He says, I need to copy one nearly full 2-terabyte drive to another new 2-terabyte drive. What's the best, fastest method to do that? Is there anything that'll let me pause the process, restart the computer, and pick up where it left off? So we were talking about this before the show, and there's a bunch of different methods you can use. I mean, the one that this person used, and I know because I'm intimately familiar with this person, is just go into Windows Explorer and then, you know, select an entire drive and copying it over.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the slowest, one of the slowest ways to do it, right?
A file-based copy is relatively slow. It works really well if you do want... very specific files. You know, if you don't want to take everything, that the file-based method obviously would work the best. If you're looking for a straight-out clone, I would go with a block-based method, so something like Norton Ghost, or Symantec Norton Ghost, whatever they're called now. There's Paragon Drive Backup. There's specific disk imaging software that will say, you know, I'm just going to do a direct copy from this drive to this drive with nothing in between. A lot of them have boot CDs, which I highly recommend because then it gets rid of all the other filter drivers that might be running on your system, AV, yada, yada.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the fastest possible method. However, sector-based, block-based methods will not allow you to resume, usually. So you do lose out on that. But it's also significantly faster. So, you know, a 2-terabyte drive, you could probably get done in about an hour, hour and a half is...
That's not too bad. Now, I do happen to know with this person that one of the caveats that they had that was I'm just kidding, it's me, come on. So one of the problems that I had, and this is my quarterly backup that I do at home. I've got two data drives, both 2-terabyte. They sit there, and then I back them up about every quarter. And I know, not the best practice, but this is what I do.
Mm-hmm.
But the drive that I was copying to was a shelled, it was a case drive. So I couldn't put it in my USB 3 dock, and so my bottleneck there was USB 2.
Mm-hmm.
So in that case, Windows Explorer is probably not going to be much slower than a Robocopy or anything else, because I think my bottleneck's probably going to be my USB 2.0, right?
There is a fair amount of overhead by using USB 2.0. I mean, ideally, you'd crack it open and, you know, use it right on the SATA bus.
Yeah.
But again, using it offline is going to be your fastest method. Don't let anything in the OS, virus scanners, filter drivers, get in the way for a straight data copy.
Okay, cool. Awesome. All right, next question. It's not even a question, but I do want to point this out, that if you use the Mail app in Windows 8 and you want to know more about it, there's a great blog post here on TechNet. This is from the Exchange Team's blog, and it's just talking about using Windows 8 Mail app in your organization. So tell us about some of the things that you've seen and some of the caveats people might need to know about.
So if you're hooking up a Windows RT device and it uses Exchange ActiveSync policies, what you can do in those policies is, you know, provision it so that only certain types of devices that expresses capabilities are able to connect. If you go too high in those Exchange policies, Windows RT will not be able to adapt, and it'll just say we can't connect to your Exchange server due to the policies in place. So you have to kind of ratchet those down. This along the full device encryption stuff with Exchange ActiveSync and being able to encrypt external storage. Mm-hmm. So those policies can potentially cause some issues for you. So the thing that you want to do is look at the policies that you have in place for your Exchange server and figure out which are the ones that you absolutely require.
Yeah.
Start off with the least amount and then go with the most. You start ratcheting it up. And then if any of your devices, not just Windows RT, this applies to anything that uses Exchange ActiveSync, so phones, iPhone, Android, Windows Phone, they might, if you need to support all of them, they don't all necessarily line up as being able to handle all of the same policies, so you can't just take it for granted that, hey, I've got these set of policies and then all devices are going to be able to connect without any issues.
Yeah.
So you do have to go and test what is capable of being handled across all those devices. If you do find out that, hey, you know, some devices work with certain set of policies, some work with other policies, you can start creating new organizational units in your Exchange infrastructure to say, like, okay, so these people, these particular accounts, they get these set of policies, these users get these set of policies. It gets a little bit harder to manage, but that will get you the maximum amount of coverage.
Cool. Okay. And we'll link to this on the show notes, so you can just jump to it from there. Next question from Scott. I just was emailing you to get your opinion on the removal of malware. I was wondering what you consider the best way to remove malware is, and is there any order you would run those programs? What's the best program to use that will not mess with the PC when removing the malware? And how are you sure that you removed all forms of malware? That's a good question. I saw some picture on, you know, the pictures on Reddit that are like, you know, meme pictures, but one of them was, don't know if my antivirus sucks or that I just haven't gotten a virus. So how do you know that you're actually detecting a virus there, and what would you recommend as far as things to use?
I mean, it's a pretty loaded question, right? I'm going to attack the last question first. How can I be certain that I've gotten rid of malware if I had it on there?
Yeah.
There, fundamentally speaking, depending on the type of machine that you have, there are things, you know, BIOS rootkits, you know, they do exist. They're not very common, mind you, but they technically do exist. If you get infected by one of those, there's nothing beyond like a BIOS reflash that will get rid of that particular issue. But let's say you have a normal kind of virus or malware in your system, the only certain method is by a clean format. So you have to format the drive, reinstall from media, get your data from a clean backup source. That is really the only method. You cannot be certain otherwise what the state of the machine is, because there can be things that look like they're legitimate, that are malware, that may not be immediately detectable, things that will only activate after a later period of time, so essentially it lays dormant.
Yeah.
Polymorphic code. There's lots of things where, you know, no one piece of AV software is perfect. I particularly do like, and other people do like, Security Essentials. Again, it is not the end-all and be-all of AV software.
Yeah.
It all depends on what kind of risk that you're putting your machine at, right? So if you're not downloading things that are from high-risk areas, then generally speaking, you should be fine. If you're using Internet Explorer in protected mode, if you're running a 64-bit OS, you can run the 64-bit IE. If you're running Windows 8, that's 64-bit IE by default. If you're running the Windows, the modern version of Windows of IE, so in Windows 8, that one doesn't allow plugins, so again, you're further protected there. It's an actually enhanced protected mode if you're running the Metro version of IE. But again, there's no one perfect method of preventing. Windows Defender has this great thing that allows you to create a boot CD that scans your system in an offline state,
yeah,
which is great. Created on a machine that you know has no risk of malware on it, or otherwise.
And you've slid into pick of the week area. This was your pick of the week anyway.
This was my pick of the week. Getting two birds with one stone here. This will allow you to scan the machine so that nothing else should be interfering with it. Again, barring the whole BIOS rootkit level kind of things. This is a great tool. There are other tools out there that will also do offline scanning. The offline scan is the best method to know that there's nothing else interfering, because you can have like super, super smart malware that is trying to evade your malware scanner.
Yeah.
Right? It's the level of sophistication keeps going up and up.
Yeah.
Keep your definitions up to date. You know, this is all basically standard stuff. But don't just rely on any one piece of AV to think that you're completely protected. But the best thing you can do is safe habits.
Yeah.
Don't do anything high risk. Online games, playing online poker, downloading ActiveX controls, just downloading software in general that's not signed, that looks weird, that's asking for elevation.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of these things are the visual cues that we're trying to give you, that's like, hey, be careful. Make sure that you know what you're doing.
Yeah.
And that's for just system-level malware. Malware is getting a lot trickier nowadays, and some of them, they're not even asking for elevation, which means that they, like, what do you care about more? Do you care about your OS and infecting other users on your system, or do you care about your data? Like, if you have sensitive data on your hard drive, there's, potentially nothing stopping it from accessing that data and copying it off to a web server somewhere.
Yeah.
So, keep your firewall rules up to date. Make sure that you have inbound, outbound scanning with your AV software. You know, its heuristics are designed to look at that kind of behavior and alert you to things that shouldn't be happening. Again, with, Windows 8 and the new apps, the Windows Store apps, it's a walled garden. You know, people call it a walled garden.
Yeah.
It means that, other apps can't interfere with other apps. So they're all isolated. That is a level of security that we have not really seen widespread use of in the OS. The other thing to that is IE, which has Lowrights IE. It runs in a more protected barrier, and we've had that since Windows 7.
Mm-hmm.
So this is our shift to start isolating what things can do on your system to keep you protected.
Yeah. Okay, cool. All right, and then my pick of the week is Flux. So Flux, it's been around for a while, and I'm sure a lot of you have heard about it. Is this front page? You can just probably go back. I think you were clicking through, looking at it. For those of you who don't know about it, Flux is an application that you can install on your system, and it will change the brightness and color temperature of your machine depending on what time of day it is. And so when you install it, it says what's your location, where you locate it at, and you put in your actual like longitude, latitude, and then you tell it what time it is and all this, and then it goes through and changes your computer throughout the day. At night, it's a little bit warmer, kind of an orangey look to it. In the daytime, it's a little bit more blue and bright.
Mm-hmm.
And I did this because I'm up working late at night and my eyes are just burning, and I'm getting to the point where I had to go. I've led a long, rich life with laughter and love and good eyesight, And now the day has come where I had to get glasses. And so it was time to like start looking at, you know, why do my eyes hurt so bad in the middle of the night? Oh, I'm staring at a light bulb full of text in the mm-hmm. middle of the night in my room, because, of course, my office at home is pitch dark. It's the Batcave. And right. so having this helps adjust your eyes for both night. Makes it a little bit easier if you're working, then you go right to bed. Mm-hmm. Your eyes aren't as sore from looking at a very bright screen. So I've been using it for a while. I'll let you know what I think. I don't know if it's something that I can really get into. I'm kind of a stickler for like color temperatures and things like that. So when I'm working in like Photoshop, I definitely don't want anything like this. And there is a function in there when you click on it in the sys tray that says, let me just work normal for an hour, and it will disable all this stuff.
Have you ever heard of the magnifier option? One of the things that you just brought up, and it triggered something, is you're reading black text on white background and yeah. burning your eyes.
Yeah.
Have you seen this option in magnifier that turns on color inversion?
Yes. Yes.
I love this
yeah,
option.
That is pretty cool, but it's one of those things that I completely forget about.
Everybody completely forgets about.
It's a keyboard shortcut.
I occasionally use this at night as well in bed on the computer. It makes my life so much better when applications and websites, they don't have a theme associated with them, you know, to invert it. I mean, we've taken this approach with the Windows Phone 8 and Windows Phone 7
yeah.
as well, is that, hey, you know, it's actually a lot easier to read light text on dark background. It's mm-hmm. a lot less strain on your eyes. Certainly less strain on my eyes.
Yeah, you're not pouring as much light into the eye
right.
that way, at least.
That is my method that that works for me, plus my glasses, which
yeah.
cuts out much of the blue spectrum. But Flux is actually pretty cool in that you don't even have to think about it. You don't have to turn anything on. It just does it for you. But, you know, if you're in a situation where you can't install software, the magnifier with color inversion is
Yeah, I'm talking to Daniel Hubble of the accessibility team in a couple of weeks here. So if you have any questions about that, I'm going to definitely bring this up too. But leave them in the show notes and I'll hit them on that.
This would be a pretty cool idea to bake into the OS.
Yeah, especially need a keyboard shortcut for that. So I can do it quick without having to go into anything. And your glasses, what kind of glasses do you use? Because I got yellow lenses on my glasses, which are supposed to make it, and it does. I mean, when you're looking at screens, it makes it much nicer
oh, yeah,
to
absolutely.
Look at the screen.
Everything is as you say, it's warmer. It's not brighter, it's
yeah.
just warmer. These are Oakleys with parsimon
yeah.
lenses. I've had them now for, I think, 2 years.
Oh, they're your staple. So the ones
yeah.
I got were Gunners. They're a little bit more yellow than
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
Yours seem a little bit more amber. But yeah, it's kind of nice. I'm not used to it yet, and I'm definitely not going to be wearing these when I'm not using a computer.
right.
But I can't bear to wear glasses. But, you know, that's cool. It's nice lenses there.
It could also be, you know, telling you, hey, get off the computer and go
yeah.
to bed.
There is that. You know, you go look at Reddit for 5 minutes, and next thing you know, it's the morning. Okay, so that's the show for this week. If you have questions, you can email us at defrag at Microsoft.com, defragshow
sure.
at Microsoft.com. We got them both. So email us, or you can leave a comment in the show notes, and we'll get back to you there. But we love the email, because
mm-hmm.
then Gove can go back and forth in the middle of the night while I just kind of roll over and look at my phone and giggle. So there is that. And we'll
can
see
you see him giggling like a schoolgirl?
Yeah, it's the middle of the night. All right, and we'll see you next week.
Take care.